香歌莫就把
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Thank you. Tep, and good evening, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. Take me out to the old ball game. Yes, indeed. I'm so happy that you're able to join me this afternoon, this evening. We have a wonderful and dynamic discussion. We have a wonderful guest, Mr. Dennis Biddle, who will be here with me. And we're going to be talking about that old America's supposedly favorite game, baseball. But we're going to talk about it from a different perspective. We want to talk about it as it relates to the African-American experience. We want to talk about the old Negro Baseball League and very clearly its significance and its importance in the African-American community. We had this program previously on our Blog Talk Radio Network system about a year and a half ago, and we decided to bring it to the forefront once again because there is a very critical part to this topic that we would like to discuss this evening. And since it's baseball season, you've got a World Series, I think, that's starting tonight, and also you have a you had recently the Milwaukee Brewers who were making a bid for the World Series but were unfortunate, not able to make it. So I thought maybe it would be a good time for us to talk about it. And then Milwaukee is the home of one of the programs that highlights and has been heralding the Negro Baseball League. It's called the Yesterday Negro Baseball League, and it's under the leadership of our guest tonight, Mr. Dennis Biddle. So we're going to be talking with him and dealing with that subject. And as I said, it's a very critical one because we're going to talk about the economics of it and how baseball was used by the African-American community to fill in some economic gaps. But it also was a social institution because it was an opportunity for families and communities to come together and enjoy themselves on a sunny evening in the summer watching their favorite teams play. So we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Also, as I said, we are here every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. This is the Time for an Awakening .com radio system. It is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network, and we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. We are also on the Blog Talk platform on Saturday afternoons from 4 to 6 p.m. And the Black Reality Think Tank is focusing the same area, talking about things that impact the African-American community. And we have a very exciting guest, some very exciting young producers who work with us on that Saturday afternoon program, Ms. Shani B. and Ms. Lady B., who talk about issues impacting young people, millenniums, post-millenniums. They talk about things that are very critical and significant to them as well. And then we are also on Sunday evening for a program called Gospel Gold that's also hosted by Reverend Michael Rogers, and this program is aired every Sunday evening from 11 p.m. to midnight. And it highlights the significance and the history of gospel music in Black America. And it's a wonderful program. And you will listen to that every Sunday evening from 11 to 12 midnight. And so those are our three lineup programs. And we thank you for your patronage. We thank you for your listening participation. And we hope that you will continue to do so. You can always go to our Facebook page at the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page and see any of our programs and when they'll be due and when they're coming on and what we'll be talking about each and every week. And we want you to continue to support us. And again, as I said, we thank you so much. Each week, we always like to do our ancestral profile. We have our ancestral profile part of our program where we look at our one of our ancestors, one of those who have gone on. As the great Fannie Lou Hamer says, we always have to stop and praise those bridges that brought us over. And so we do that with our ancestral profile. And so tonight, we are going to give honor to a very dear ancestor. And it is a woman. Her name is Toni, T-O-N-I, Stone. Toni Stone. T-O-N-I, Stone. Tony Stone was born on July the 17th, 1921. And she transitioned to the ancestral realm on November the 2nd, 1996. She was born as Marcinia Lau Stone. That was her name at birth. Marcinia Lau Stone in Bluefield, West Virginia. She was the first of three women to play professional baseball as a part of the Negro Leagues. The first of three women to play baseball as a part of the Negro League. Toni Stone attended the Roosevelt High School in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She was a baseball player from her early childhood. She went on to play for the San Francisco Sea Lions in the West Coast Negro Baseball League in 1945. And in 1953, she was traded to the Indianapolis Clowns of the Negro League. And in 1954, she signed to the Kansas City Monarchs. She was raised in St. Paul, Minnesota, in a little neighborhood called Rondo, the Rondo neighborhood of St. Paul, Minnesota. Ms. Stone's playing career began when she was 10 years old, and she joined the St. Peter Claver Catholic Church Boys baseball team in the Catholic Midget League, which is similar today to the Little Leagues. She moved on to play for the girls' Hollicks softball club in St. Paul, Minnesota. By the age of 15, Toni Stone played for the St. Paul Giants, which was a men's semi-professional team. Ms. Stone soon began playing on All Love's American Legion Championship team. She began her professional career with the San Francisco Sea Lions in 1949, where she battled and knocked in two home runs on her first time to bat and her first time playing with the San Francisco Sea Lions. Toni soon became discontented with the owner of the Sea Lions after she did not receive the opportunity to play as she had been promised. So she quit the team and joined the Black Pelicans of New Orleans. After a short stint with the Black Pelicans, Stone joined the New Orleans Creoles from 1949 to 1952. She was signed by a man by the name of Sid Pollock, who is the owner of the Indianapolis Clowns, in 1953 to play second base. This is the same position that Hank Aaron played for the Indianapolis Clowns 1 year earlier. She did this as part of a publicity stunt. The Clowns were simply compared to the Harlem Globetrotters of the basketball world. And so having a woman on the team seemed to have attracted more fans. But during the 50 games that Stone played for the Clowns, she maintained a .243 batting average, and one of her hits was off the legendary Satchel Paige. All of these accomplishments may make her one of the best players you have never heard of. And according to the National League Baseball Players Association website, Stone's contract was later sold to the Kansas City Monarchs prior to the 1954 season, and she retired following that season because of lack of playing time. After the 1954 season, Toni Stone moved to Oakland, California to work as a nurse and to care for her sick husband, who later died in 1987 at the age of 103. Toni Stone died on November 2nd, 1996 at a nursing home in Alameda, California. She was 75 years old. Stone was the first female player, as we said, of the Negro Leagues. And, you know, she was not met with open arms. They did not welcome her into playing. Most of the men shunned her. They gave her a hard time because she was a woman. Stone was quite proud of the fact that the male players were out to get her. She was glad because then she would show them off, and she would show the scars on her left hand and remember the time she had been spiked by a runner trying to take out the woman standing on second base. He was out, she recalled. Even though she was part of the team, she was not allowed in the locker room. If she was lucky, she would be allowed to change in the umpire's locker room. Once Stone was asked to wear a skirt while playing for sex appeal, but she would not do it. Even though she felt like she was one of the guys, the people, the players around her did not. While playing for the Kansas City Monarchs, she spent much of the game on the bench, next to the men who actually hate her, as her biographer had said. It was hell, she said. I caught living hell. Toni Stone became one of the first women to play as a regular on a big league professional team in 1953, which I said was the Kansas City Monarchs. In 1985, Stone was inducted into the Women's Sports Foundation International Women's Sports Hall of Fame. In 1990, she was included in two exhibits at the Baseball Hall of Fame, one of women in baseball and another on Negro League baseball. In 1993, Stone was inducted into the Women's Sports Hall of Fame, as well as the Sudafed International Women's Sport Hall of Fame. In 1990, Stone's hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota, declared March the 6th, Toni Stone Day. St. Paul was also named a field, a playing field, a baseball playing field, was named after her. And it's located at the Dunning Baseball Complex. And as I said earlier, she was 75 years old when she died. Miss Toni Stone, first woman in professional baseball. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are so happy again, as I said earlier, to be here with you. We have a wonderful program with the guests, Mr. Dennis Biddle. He is online, and I'm waiting to bring him on and introduce him. I just want to kind of preliminarily say, for the interest of our listening audience, that the Negro Baseball League was a very powerful and critical institution in Black America. It existed, obviously, during the times of segregation, and it was played a pivotal part in developing economic and social opportunities for African Americans. Everybody was involved in it. It's embraced in all the activities. You can't pull it out and isolate it from all of the other Black history and life. It is a part of everything: economics, politics, social, religious. Very big part of the religious standing, because the Black Church often supported the Negro Baseball Leagues, and a lot of them. And most of the games, as Mr. Biddle will be able to tell you, a lot of them were played on Sunday evenings. And a lot of the churches were a part of the sponsorships of some of the teams. A lot of the teams would allow the churches to run the concession stands and make money. A lot of them were promoted through the churches, undertakers, barbershops, beauty salons. All of them were a part of the economic structure of the Negro Baseball League. A lot of families would get together. They would have picnics and go to the games. Fields, the ownership of the ball fields sometimes were in the hands of a lot of the men and women who ran and owned the baseball teams. And I recall as a young man myself in the 1940s, the early 1950s in North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina, there was a Negro baseball team there called the Durham Rams, and we would many times go to the games all on Sunday afternoon. There were some games on Saturday and places like that, but most of them were on Sunday afternoon after church. So about 3 o'clock, 3:30, the games would start. And so this was a wonderful institution. And so tonight we want to discuss that. We want to discuss it in a way that helps you understand how it happened. Even it starts in a way that how it was ended. It gets into the political fight. At the time, the 1920s and the 1930s, the general sentiment of the Black community was moving toward integration. They felt that that was the correct order of the day, is to go toward integration. But as a result of that, it killed the baseball league, and when it did that, and it was never able to gain its footing. And so Mr. Biddle is going to talk about that for us. The first nationally known Black professional baseball team was founded back in 1885 when three clubs, which were the Keystone Athletics of Philadelphia, and the Orioles of Philadelphia, and the Manhattans of Washington, D.C., merged to form a team called the Cuban Giants. The success of the Cubans led to the creation of the first organized Negro League in 1887, which was called the National Colored Baseball League. It was organized strictly as a minor league, and it was founded with six teams: the Baltimore Lord Baltimores, Boston Resolutes, the Louisville Falls Cities, the New York Gorhams, the Philadelphia Pythians, and the Pittsburgh Keystones. Two more of the teams joined before the season ended, and they played a couple of games. They were the Cincinnati Browns and the Washington Capital Cities. The league was led by a man by the name of Walter S. Brown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He applied for and was granted official minor league status and thus protection under the major league-led national agreement. This move prevented any team in organized baseball from signing any of those players, which also locked the players to their particular teams within the league. The reserve clause would have tied the teams to their clubs from season to season, but somehow, in the history of all of this, it failed. 1 month into the season, the Resolutes folded. A week later, there were only three teams left. Because the original Cuban Giants were a popular and very successful business, many similarly named teams came into existence. They were called the Cuban X Giants, which was a spinner group and a powerhouse kind of around the 1900 original group. Then there came another group called the Genuine Cuban Giants. This was named after the original Cuban Giants. The Columbia Giants, the Brooklyn Royal Giants, and so on. The early Cuban term were all composed of African Americans, however, rather than Cubans. And the purpose of doing that was to increase their acceptance with white patrons, as Cuba was on very friendly terms with the Americans in the early turn of the century, during those years. So beginning in 1899, several Cuban baseball teams played, however, in North America, including the All Cubans, the Cuban Stars West, the Cuban Stars East, and the New York Cubans. Some of them included white Cuban players, and some were Negro League players. So this is the history of the beginning of that. And then as we moved on into the toward the early beginnings of the 20th century, we began to find more of that, and we're going to discuss that in a few minutes. But tonight our guest is a young man who had played in the at the closing latter years of the Negro Baseball League. The Negro Baseball League played up until the early 1980s, the 70s, and Mr. Biddle can clarify that for us. The Indianapolis Clowns were the longest playing Negro baseball team. They were the last team to close out. And what really, as some argue, started the downfall of the team was when the major league teams began to accept black ball players. And that seemed to have been the goal for what many wanted to do, was to integrate into those white leagues. And we all know the story of the Brooklyn Dodgers and Jackie Robinson. And then eventually Satchel Paige going and some of the others that ended up going into those major leagues. So this young man played toward the end of that period of time. And he's going to talk a little bit about who he played for and some of the challenges that he had. And what he has tried to do is to, you had a lot of veterans from those latter years, and he has been trying to work with them and provide for them to get a pension and for them to be able to have money as they were getting older and moving to the real winter of their years. And he has met some very stiff resistance from a lot of people that I want you to talk about, those that were even claiming that he wasn't real, that he didn't play for this and didn't play for that, and very clearly he has all of the evidence to prove that he did. One of the problems that the Negro Leagues had is that they did not keep real good records. There were not a lot of facts that you would normally do for an institution, and so that was one of their major struggles, is trying to prove that. There's a museum in Kansas City, Missouri, dedicated to the Negro Baseball League, and we can talk about that as well, too. But right now, I want our audience to welcome and meet Mr. Dennis Biddle from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He has recently been honored by the Milwaukee Brewers for his work that he did. As a matter of fact, in one of their games, they all wore the colors and the uniform of the Negro baseball team. And again, Mr. Biddle can tell you about that as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you Mr. Dennis Biddle. Good evening, Mr. Biddle.
Hello. How you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Doing great.
You pretty well put it together. The history, but there's so much more.
I'm sure it is.
That was not written down.
I'm sure it is.
About the history of the Negro baseball league.
Right, right.
And I would like to share some of that with you today.
Please do.
Yeah. I started playing in 1953 right out of high school with the Chicago American Giants in Chicago. At that time, most of the Negro League team was being used as one of Branch Rickey's long-range goals. They never talk about that, but Branch Rickey's long-range goal was to eventually, he knew by signing one, it was going to be a devastating blow for the Negro League. So he set in motion a long-range goal. When it does happen, going to use the Negro League team as a minor league system for the major leagues. And you know, that's what it really was, without the credibility. They talk about all the players that came from the Negro League to the major league, but those players were prepared by some of these older guys, and some of them living today. A lot of them gone home to glory, but they were too old to go in when Jackie opened the door, so they reverted into preparing the younger players. And I was one of those young players, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, all of us, Ernie Banks. We were in the Negro League being prepared. You know, we were playing on the team, but it didn't matter what team you played on. If one of those trainers that was managed with the other team saw you doing something wrong, he got on you too. So this part of our history, it was not written down.
Right.
League went from 1920 to 1960. And I must say, you covered a lot of the history up to 1949, 1950. You know, mm-hmm. There were three newspapers, you know, that covered the games during that time.
Right.
And that's where a lot of the historians and the writers got their information from, because people that write about our history, most of them weren't even born when we were playing.
Okay.
So they had to get it from somewhere. So they got it. It was pretty well documented up to 1949, 1950. After that, you're going to find very little written down about the history from 1950 to 1960 when it died. Even after it died in 1960, there were two or three teams trying to keep it going, the Monarchs, the Clowns, and a few other Stars. They were trying to keep it going, but it was gone. It was gone.
Right.
It had lived its, ran its course. So, this is what we are living with today.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I believe the Lord put me in there to do.
Right.
It's what I do now.
Talk a little bit about
the history of the Negro League.
Right.
Revolved around Branch Rickey introducing Jackie Robinson to the major league, and they don't even report that accurately, because even only Jackie could tell you what really happened. Mr. Sherwood Brewer. Mr. Brewer started this organization that I'm the president of now, Yesterday Negro League. The reason we call it Yesterday is, I don't know if you noticed or not, is that the word Negro League belongs to anybody that want to use it.
Okay.
And they're using it all over the country, making millions of dollars off of our name and likeness. None of that money is going to those old men who made the history. And most of them, a lot of them, are gone on to glory now.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Sherwood Brewer took it upon himself to try to bring the players that were still living together to try to get some benefits or some recognition of their time, their tenure in the Negro Baseball League. And he did a great job. But it was like he was looking for someone that would help him, and that was me. In 1995, the Kansas City Monarchs hosted the 75th year anniversary of the Negro Baseball League. I was in attendance, and that's where I met Mr. Brewer. And I'll never forget, in the airport coming back home, Mr. Brewer lived in Chicago. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. On our way back home at the airport, he came. It was something that pushed him up to me.
Okay.
And we started talking. We got together. And he told me what he was trying to do. And that was my belief also. So I joined him. And with some help of a lot of people, and this is something that's in two books. Voices from the Negro League is one book. My autobiography is in there. So is Mr. Brewer and how we started this organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written a book called Secrets of the Negro Baseball League, which is on the market now,
right.
as told by Dennis Biddle. That book described the hardship, the thing that Mr. Sherwood Brewer and I went through for the last, he passed away about 5 years ago. But up until that time, the thing that we went through trying to organize the what was left of the Negro Baseball League. We ran into a lot of oppositions, a lot of hatred, a lot of honorees, including some of the players. And in my book, I write about one of the last statements Mr. Brewer said to me before he died. He called me kid. He said, kid, you're going to find out that some of your own is going to be your worst enemy.
Why that do you think there was so much resistance from the players? Why was there so much resistance from those players and others about you all trying to capture this memory? Okay. It would seem that they would like that.
That was because some of the players had been contacted by organizations out there claiming to represent us.
Oh, okay.
They would give them a few dollars to stand up with them. And that's why it was so difficult for Mr. Brewer to get all the players together. And he used to tell them whenever we got together, he used to say, if we stood together as one, we would be a force to reckon with. But those guys didn't understand that.
Right.
If some organization out there gave them a few dollars to come in and do this, or say this, or that, they would do it. And that was something that went on even in the league, but untold.
Okay.
There was a lot of imminence and players hating each other. Because one player thought the other player was making more money than he was. He was getting some extra. And it goes on until Mr. Brewer organized the foundation with me, and we made sure that the players that signed up with the organization knew the whole truth of what happened and what was happening.
Right.
And there has been a lot of things happen since 1996 when we organized up until now. I represent them. We have about 56 players, and that could be more, a little more, a little less, still living.
Oh, still living now? There's 56 players
still? Last recollection, yes, sir.
Okay.
31 of them is 90 or more years old.
Fantastic.
Thanks to the Milwaukee Brewers, and that's another story. 1923, Milwaukee had a team in the Negro Baseball League. And Mr. Brewer and I capitalized on that with the Milwaukee Braves and the Brewers. And every year, we honor players. The Brewers bring them into town, and we are honored there. The opposing team wearing the old uniforms that we played in. And it's a big thing, a big night for those players get some recognition.
What was the name of that team? Let our audience know the name of that team.
And Milwaukee had a team called the Milwaukee Bears.
Right.
They played 1 year here in Milwaukee. And that's the team that the Brewers honor every year.
Okay.
But there's so much more. You know, I travel the world over. I speak all over the country about the true history. And I emphasize the true history, because a lot of our history was not written down.
Right.
I talk about, and I write about, I'm writing the third book now, but I talk about, I was 17 years old riding that bus with these old men who had been through life and never had a chance to display those tremendous talents they had in the major league because of the color of the skin. These men somehow knew that the true history would not be revealed.
Right.
And I believe to this day, this is why they were telling me about things that happened before I was born in the Negro Baseball League.
Right.
Because they knew it was not going to be passed down to our generation.
Right.
So this is what I do. I believe because I went to the Cubs in 55. I was one of those young players that was trained, prepared for the major league.
Mm-hmm.
The Chicago Cubs purchased my contract. And this is something that you're not going to find written down much.
Right.
Hank Aaron, Ernie Bank, Willie Mays, we all had those long binding contracts. And there's a reason for that, too. I can tell you why that was passed down to me. But if a team were interested, and one of those players, they had to purchase their contract. And the team that we were on would get enough money to pay those older guys that was training us to keep our league going. This is what the historians and the writers missed. They didn't know this.
Right.
And this is what I passed down to my young people, along with Mr. Sherwood Brewer played for the Kansas City Monarchs. When Jackie Robinson came to the Monarchs, Mr. Brewer was playing second base. He moved over to shortstop and let Jackie play second.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that passed a lot of this history down to me of what really, he was there.
Right.
And I really loved that man because Bobby Robertson, Double Duty Radcliffe, Buck Leonard, James Bell, all of these guys was in my, during my time. Talked to me, passed history down to me, told me about things that happened. And I'll never forget it. I write about it.
Right.
And I'm the third book I'm writing now. I'm revealing more of the history.
Good. Excellent.
But I just want to emphasize the fact that a lot of those organizations that was claiming to represent us resented me, and they were looking for ways and things to prove that I didn't play in the league.
Right.
Try to discredit me.
Yeah.
And so I was lucky enough, my first wife, was lucky enough to have the contract I had with the Chicago American Giant was based on a scrapbook. And she passed away, but I had a chance to get a copy of it, and I put it in my book because I wanted my young people to know how the Major League broke up the Negro League. Right. It took all the young players. I was one of those young players.
Right.
The contract I signed in 1953 is in my book, a copy of it, because I want them to know what really happened.
I guess. Let me ask you something that I think is also critical to understand what was going on. A lot of the Negro Baseball League history and activity was going on in between world wars. You had the closing down of World War One in 1919, and you had the onset of Nazism and World War II, the Korean War, and all of that was in the backdrop of the ball leagues beginning to play. How did that impact the environment for playing? You know, because I'm sure a lot of people were going into the military, had to go into the military, you know, during those times. Can you recall just exactly what type of impact that those world wars had, on the players and on the environments of the community, at that time?
Yes. A lot of the players did go to the military. Mr. Brewer spent 3 years in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to explain a few things about the military because this is the part of our history that they didn't write down.
Okay.
The Negro League, and I know people our age remember the Depression. Once the Depression hit, the Negro League folded up. This is what was passed down to me. If they didn't have money to continue. But they were saved. The white businessmen purchased 16 of those teams and brought them back to play to make more money. Mm. This is a part of the history they don't even talk about. The Negro League folded up in 1929.
Hmm.
And what happened is white businessmen, there was a few, two or three black owners, but most of them were white businessmen. They had money. Their first order of business was to put these teams together to play each other, okay? And what happened is that the owners of those teams that had the money hired black men fronting as they owned the team. And I know this sounds bad, excuse me, but this is the truth. This was passed down to me.
Okay.
They set out to make more money. They hired black men fronting as they owned the team. He didn't make no decision. The decision was made under the table. This is why we had the All-Star game. This is why we had the black team playing the Major League team.
Okay.
This is why the Negro League team was playing in the Major League parks when the Major League team was out of town.
Okay.
They couldn't play on the team, but they rented them the park. That was done by the people that owned the team that made money. They put together an All-Star game and made more money.
Mm-hmm.
This is the reason Jackie Robinson was sneaked in on them. They don't talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
They write all this stuff about Jackie. Mr. Brewer was there when Jackie came. He said they took Jackie into a room and sat him down and said, Jackie Press Rick is looking for someone. He have interviewed over 200 black men to be the first one and turn them down.
Right.
And, you've been to college, you played with and against white, and all you got to do is understand what you got to go through. So we're going to take you on the road with us for 1 year and show you what you got to encounter when you get up there. They took Jack. You don't find this written nowhere. They took him on the road for 1 year. They show a little in some of the extracts of the movies a little bit on the bus ride. But Jackie was one in the Negro League for 1 year, being prepared to do what he did. Jackie didn't just walk up like they portrayed he did.
Exactly. That makes sense.
That was over 200 men interviewed by Branch Rickey to be the first one.
Right.
He turned them down. Uh-huh. I did the research because I wanted to know why he turned them down.
Right.
It was simple, because of their attitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They did not understand. They would not accept what they would have to go through being the first one.
Right.
Yeah, that's why Cypher Page wasn't first.
Right.
Josh Gibson was a name because Ricky knew they put them in there and they called him a name, they were going to mess it up. Mm-hmm. So he had to have someone that was not fight back, and Jackie was that person after he had been told what he had to do, and he accepted it.
Okay.
But that, you know, and the rest is history.
Right. Now, in my research, it appears that the prime years for the Negro Baseball League in terms of black participation, black ownership, making money was around the 1920s, 1925, 1930. Is that correct from your understanding?
I didn't understand. You the time when what?
When the teams were basically in the control of black player, I mean black owners,
okay.
And the black community was benefiting from their work. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. 1920, Rube Foster started the Negro League.
Okay.
And it was most of the people, most of the owners were black owners.
Okay. Right.
They were black racketeers. They was musicians. They were movie stars.
Right.
Those are the people that owned the Negro League team. Any black person that had money enough to buy some uniforms or a bus on a Negro League team.
Right.
And that went on until the Depression.
Okay.
But that was what baseball became America's greatest pastime.
Exactly.
Because most of the people at those games were black.
Hmm.
But it changed after the Depression. If you look at some of the pictures they got after the Depression, there were black and white all together in stands.
Right.
And before then, you know, in my book, I got a poster. The first game I picked was in Memphis, Tennessee, against the Memphis Red Sox. And that poster said, "Space reserved for white owners."
Right, exactly. That makes sense.
You know, that's the way it was back in that
day.
But after the Depression, things changed drastically.
Right.
And,
now, let me ask you, what was it about Kansas City that made it such a boom town for baseball? I think the Kansas City Monarchs, from what I hear and what I've read, were one of the standout teams of the time. And I know that that community was very strong and supportive of the Kansas City Monarchs. So what was it about the city of Kansas? Kansas City, Missouri, correct? Not Kansas City, Kansas.
Kansas City was the main office of the Negro Baseball League.
Right, right.
That's what the office was. And they got a museum there now. But Kansas City was owned by white businessmen after the Depression.
Okay.
They had money they could buy. See, our contracts. And this was told to me, my contract was binding. I couldn't go to another team.
Okay.
Unless they told me that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a long binding contract, but if you look at some of those contracts, they were not binding. So if you were on the Negro League team and I was a great hitter, you would offer me more money than what I'm getting there, that's where I was going.
Okay.
That's why you see a lot of the players living today went to different teams. They played on three or four different teams. a lot of the players that's gone home in glory played on a lot of different teams because of that. But when I came, it was during the time when the transition was being made to prepare us for the major. Jackie had opened the door. So we came in. They used it as a money-making industry for the team.
Right.
Prepare the younger player for the major league.
Right.
And you know, it's there's so much about that history that has not been written down. And thank God there are players still living today.
Right, right.
That can reveal this history like it really was.
Right.
You know, and I'm thankful to the Chicago Memphis Courier and Pittsburgh Courier, Chicago Sun, Chicago
Defender.
Tribune, I think it was.
Chicago Defender.
Defender, yeah, yeah. Chicago Defender. Those were the papers that those were the three newspaper, black newspapers that followed, kept the history together the best they could.
Right.
And this is why, so, you know, if you played in the Negro League 15 years, and I'm a historian, I'm going to come to you, I'm going to interview you.
Right.
And I'm going to ask you, you played with the Chicago American Giants.
Right.
And you stopped playing 1949. You asked me the question, when did Chicago stop playing? 1949.
Right.
That's all he knows. And that's what messed up the history. This guy will write this down, put it in the history book, and that's what the biggest lie ever was.
Right, exactly.
You know.
And that's why, I'm sorry.
That's what a lot of history are.
Okay. But that's why I asked you about Kansas City, too, because I know Kansas City had a newspaper called the Kansas City Call. And I know that they were heavily behind the Monarchs. And then the fact that, like you said, it had to have some power there. But what I think is interesting to me about Kansas City is centered around the baseball team, it developed a very powerful business community. You had barbecue restaurants right. opening up everywhere. You know, you had jazz. Nightclubs popped up all around the Kansas City Jazz, you know. And I remember that song years ago called Kansas City, Here I Come. You remember that?
I remember that. And
you look at Kansas City, you say, well, why Kansas City? I could see Chicago, I could see New York.
Well, Chicago was too now. Chicago had three teams.
Okay.
Kansas City had three teams.
What about New York?
But that was not just the reason the three teams. A lot of the players settled in Kansas City for some reason or another.
Right.
And Kansas City, you know, was the first. That was where the office was located.
Okay.
So everything centered around Kansas City. And
what,
that's why, like that today,
York?
You
what
know.
About, what about New York?
Who?
New York, New York City. What about New York? Did they have?
New York was just a regular team. See, those owners went to New York. See, that was three teams that played at Yankee Stadium.
The
New York Cubans, the New York Yankees, and the New York Black Yankees.
Yeah, I have heard of the Black Yankees. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they all played at Yankee Stadium. And the reason they call them the Black Yankees is who playing tonight. So you got to figure out who's playing it. All three of them played at Yankee Stadium.
Okay. Now, were they owned by whites as well?
Who?
The Black Yankees, the New York Black Yankees.
Oh, he was owned by, all of them was owned by, they had, if you went to some of these old men living today in the 90s and asked him, who was the owner of the team you played on? He would give you a name, but he didn't own. See, this is why the Negro League folded up. Because, see, you really have to know the history. Brett Ritchie did a great thing when he did.
Right.
He knew what he was doing was going to be a devastating blow to the Negro League.
Right.
He knew that. And that was why he set that long range and plan in motion, because he knew But it did happen. We're going to use the Negro League as a minor league system. Now, that's what it really was without the credibility.
Right.
It was a minor league system for the major league. Okay. All those players, major league players that's in the Hall of Fame now, came from the Negro Baseball League.
Gotcha.
But what happened is they didn't know. They had all the owners, those fronters, to sign the young players to long binding contracts. So if the major league is interested, they got to purchase that contract from them, and they'll get money to keep the league going.
Right.
This is what happened. And after 9 years, and what happened, they went to the owners. Branch Rickey went to the owners to implement his plan. This was handed down to me. And Branch Rickey went to implement his plan, and those owners turned him down because they were making more money selling us to the major league than they would have been something like that.
I got you.
So they refused. And when they refused, this is what Branch Rickey, this is the history.
Okay.
Branch Rickey said, okay, Jackie opened the door 10 years ago. We don't have to come to y'all anymore for talent. We can go to the same place that you go and get talent. Now, you got to remember, that was playground, high school, colleges.
Right.
That's why Reggie Jackson,
kind of like Frank Roberts, almost
and many more of those guys never played in the Negro League because the major league went where they were and got them.
Yeah.
And signed them. The Negro League team could not compete. This is why they folded up by the end of 1960.
I've been told that that same process is used today. The football coach, for instance, of Alabama, which is right now the winningest college team in the nation, what he does is he gets in his car and drives down through all them country towns in Alabama looking for black players. And he's got some kind of little camp that he sends them to, and they train.
Well, you see, what was going on back when I was playing. The booking agent made the monkey money.
Right.
We had a little contract we signed, but the booking agent made the money because he knew the Negro League team had made a name for themselves, and they were going to be traveling through this town.
Right.
So they'd go ahead and set it up. Chicago American Giants is coming to Omaha, Nebraska to play the Kansas City Monarchs.
Right.
That's a big game.
Okay.
He got 10%, and he gone to the next town.
Now,
that was a way of Negro League baseball. Right?
Now, talk about, tell me a little bit about barnstorming and how that played into the system.
Okay, now, what was my barnstorming, mine was a little different than the originals.
Okay.
The originals were barnstorming because that was all they knew. That was all they had.
Okay.
I was doing it because I was being prepared for the major league.
Okay.
Now, the younger players, we had to do all the dirty work, carry the bat, the balls, and make sure everything is put up after the game. We had to do all the dirty work. But what I hated most, and I talk about this in my book, we would travel in Texas. Mm-hmm. We would stop at a restaurant to eat. And these older players knew they wouldn't let us come inside and eat.
Right.
So they would park the bus, and the younger player, me most of the time, had to go around in the back, stand in the hot sun for hours while they made sandwiches for everybody on the bus. I had to do that time and time again. Mm-hmm. I hated that.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing that stays in my memory today when I see things the way they are, standing in the hot sun waiting on sandwiches. Because they wouldn't let nobody in the restaurant, but yet we can't come in and sit down and eat.
Right. Let me ask you: were the Coca-Cola and the beer companies, Pass Through Ribbon, were they anywhere in this picture of backing up the Negro Leagues?
Yes.
Did they back
yes,
up?
Yes, they were.
Okay.
Yes, they were. The owner of the team had that. That was his thing.
Oh, I got you. Okay, right. Okay.
See, the players, we only got what we were promised. And sometimes we didn't get that. But You know, when it came down to marketing, the team marketing, that was done by the owners and the fronters.
Okay.
See, when Brett Ricky told the owner refused, and he told them what he was going to do, then they backed out. They left. They left those fronters. And this is why the team, this is why the league ended up with three or four teams trying to make the league, okay?
Right.
Trying to keep it going.
Okay.
When those fronters left, took the money out of it, those fronters didn't have no money. Some of them had a few dollars, and I could name some names, but I'm not naming any name because they were passed down to me. But those were the guys that had a little money. They was owning two or three teams trying to keep it together.
Okay.
This is the history.
Let me ask you about something called the gentleman's agreement from the Major League Baseball. Do you recall something like that? That was some kind of a gentleman's agreement that they had, that you all had? Is that something you remember?
Yeah, gentleman's agreement.
Yeah, Mr. Scott had texted me and asked me to ask you about the gentleman's agreement idea. Maybe if he's listening, he can come on and be a little bit more explicit about the exactly what that is.
Yeah, that was something that the players had no control of that. That was done by those owners and stuff, that gentleman's agreement. That was something they came up with, and I don't know too much about it.
Okay.
Well,
if he's listening, Mr. Scott.
It was something they used quite a bit, I think.
Okay, all right. Mr. Biddle, I'm going to take a quick break, we've got some folk that I might want to ask you a couple of questions, and then we'll come back. After they ask you questions, we're going to come back and talk about a little bit more. I have a question I want to ask you about the minor league portions of the Negro Baseball League. What were some of those other side teams, and how did they play into the game? But let's take a break right quick, and then we'll open up the lines and ask some of our folks that are online now, do they have an interesting question? If not, we'll get right back. So let's take a quick break.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Wow.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Black Reality Think Tank. I'm your host, William Rogers. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Here at timeforanawakening.com. The program is created and developed by the Sankofa Historical Society, and it is sponsored by Motherland Media Network. Motherland Media Network is has its own program here on this system. It airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and is hosted by Brother Osiemi Adelabu. That's African Perspectives. And they, as I said, they are also the sponsor of this program. And then on Friday evening, we have Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And that program airs from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. On Fridays, right here at timeforanawakening.com. And very dynamic discussion and guests and interviews that are held very dynamic. And then they're again on Sundays. They come on Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. right here at timeforanawakening.com. Again, Brother Richard, Brother Elliot out of Philadelphia, very dynamic program. And then the Black Reality Think Tank also airs on Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6 on the Blog Talk Radio system, 4 p.m. Eastern Time to 6 p.m. The program is hosted by two very dynamic young producers, Shani B. and Lady B., and they present very dynamic discussions and topics relating to the millennial generation, post-millennials, talking about things that impact them, trying to understand the political, economic, social, and the spiritual arena of Black America. And so it's a real good opportunity to hear what our young folks have to say and how they are handling things as they move forward. So we welcome you to listen to any of our programs. All of our programs are archived. You go to the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page. They are there. You can listen for any of those programs, or you can either go to the website of www.timeforanawakening.com. And all of our programs are listed there for those that are aired via the Time for an Awakening system. And you can also go to the Blog Talk system, www.blogtalkradio.com, and you can also hear the archive system there. And so we are so happy to be here and to be have opportunity to talk with our community about so many of the very important issues that impact us. Today we are here talking to Mr. Dennis Biddle, who was a part of yesterday's Negro Baseball Association, LLC, and he's been giving us some real detailed insight on the whole area of the Negro Baseball League. The Negro Baseball League was a dynamic economic entity. It was a very powerful force in our community during the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. It was there during a time of harsh, hardcore segregation, lynchings. It was there during in between the World War I, World War II, and some of those dynamic things. But it was a survival tool. It was a survival tool for African Americans because it provided some economic outlet. People were able to run concession stands. People were able to participate in the promotion of those teams. People were able to look at creating other little ventures around the games that were held on Sundays and Saturdays. As we talked about earlier, the Kansas City particular was a very interesting area and a very interesting study because the black Kansas City, Missouri, was built around the Kansas City Monarch team, which was at the time one of the most powerful black baseball teams in the country. And so a lot we hear about Kansas City Jazz, Kansas City Blues, Kansas City Barbecue, and all those various other things were built because of that team that was there. And there were other cities as well. And then the black newspapers were able to participate. The Black Press, the Kansas City Call, the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Norfolk Journal and Guide, the Baltimore Afro-American, and all of those were powerful black newspapers that were promoting this Negro Baseball League, but at the same time promoting it in a way that it was an economic opportunity for any of our people during some very hard and difficult times, the Depression, World Wars, segregation, lynchings, killings, unemployment, so many of those things that have plagued the black community for a long time. And so that's what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about how all of this impacts. We have several callers that are online. We want to kind of open up to get to them. I have one caller that I want to particularly go to because he had texted me a question for Mr. Biddle about that gentleman's agreement idea. And yeah. I asked him to, Mr. Biddle, I asked him to call us. Mr. Scott, I think he is on the line. Good afternoon, Mr. Scott. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Dr. Rogers. Great. And good afternoon to you, Mr. Biddle. How are you today?
I'm blessed, sir. Thank you.
It was, I think, maybe 2003, 2004 when I caught the lecture. We were at Lakeland Resort, and we had about maybe 170 kids or so, and you did just a phenomenal presentation. You broke down, you know, why Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige and all these guys were not selected. You said they selected Satchel. He was going to hit him with the ball if he got spit on or cursed at, and Josh was going to hit him with the bat and so forth and so on. You broke it all down in just you know, precise detail. And one thing you talked about, there was this changing of the commissioners, and this judge came in, and he was the commissioner of the major leagues, and they created this, what you call the greatest gentleman's agreement in America, something like that. And that agreement was that a black player would never, ever play in the major leagues ever again. I could have some of it wrong, but do you remember disseminating that information?
Yes, I did. That was see, in the beginning of baseball, black men were playing in the major leagues. See? They barred them out because of it was called a white man's sport. They used a gentleman's agreement to do that. That's written down. That's a part of history. You know, the gentleman's agreement came about when all the owners got together and they agreed and that they would not hire another black man to play on their team. And that's what happened. That's why it's called a great gentleman's agreement. Almost overnight, all of those great black ball players that was playing in the major league, they just disappeared from the major league and the minor league. Hmm. And it will be 20 years later before Ruth Foster organized the Negro Baseball League.
Right. Well, that was the question I had texted Dr. Rogers,
asking him to ask you about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That gentleman agreement was, it went down in history. Nothing was written down. The owners, they got together and they agreed they were going to do something, and they made it a part of law because of the Supreme Court recognized it and passed it.
Thank you so much, Mr. Biddle.
Thank you, Mr. Scott, for calling in. I appreciate that. Thank you. Mr. Biddle, let me ask you a question. I thought about in preparation for the program, I wanted to ask you this. It has something to do with the quality of playing and the talent of the players. Now, did you recently watch the game between the Brewers and the LA Dodgers this last week in terms of their playing and the game and how it was going. Did you watch much of that game?
Yes, I did.
Okay, can you tell us then, looking at the players during that game and during the years that you played, is there a difference between the quality of the players in terms of that time span? Were the ones that played back then, were they stronger?
I've been asked that many times.
Okay.
Was the players better back when y'all played than they are now? And I have to answer it as correctly as I can, because the players today are better players than we were. Now, I say that because they got better equipment, better training, better everything.
Okay.
We had to use what we had to do what we did. Okay. We were smarter than they are today. So if I had to differentiate between the two, we were smarter.
Interesting. And what do you mean by smarter? How? Give an example of that.
Because we took things, we made use of things that were not heard of to make things work.
Okay.
The helmet, the mask they wear over their face.
Right.
The discipline that we couldn't spell steroids. Now they got all kind of things to make them better. They got better training facilities.
Right.
They got everything is better now.
Okay. So when,
but we were smarter.
So
when it came to use of what we had.
Okay.
We took what we had to make the best of. We took nothing and made something.
Gotcha. I gotcha.
That's the best way to put it.
Right. So when Hank Aaron broke Willie Mays' home run record, that was based on just the quality of the player, correct? Because I've heard a lot of arguments.
That is correct. That is correct, sir.
Right.
And I want to say this to all the fans in the world, from a baseball player, and I'm not the only one that would say this, that they would say it. Steroids had nothing to do with the enhancement of a man's ability to play baseball.
Okay.
That's a God-given talent. Some got it better than others. That's why we got all-stars and not so all-stars.
Okay, gotcha.
Steroid was used as an excuse to cover up facts. And I don't want to get into that. Only baseball players know this.
Okay.
And they will tell you that. Because if you go through the records, you can see hundreds of them tried steroid to hit home runs like Barry Bonds.
Okay.
They found out it didn't work. That's not what it is. So they went back to that user stand. But the guys that were using steroids for some other reason, not to enhance their ability to play baseball, that's not why they were using steroids. Those guys playing 100-something games, you get hurt, you get aches and pain, and that's why they were taking that, to ease the pain,
gotcha.
Not to enhance their ability to play baseball. And I know I'm one of a very few baseball players who stand up and say that, because they all know it now.
Right. Okay, let's go to Brother Timothy out of Philadelphia. Brother Timothy, you got any questions or remarks about the Negro Baseball League?
First, I want to congratulate Mr. Biddles for coming on to have this conversation with us, sir. And the first thing that comes in my mind, sir, is my great-grandfather and my great-uncles and my great-aunts, because they my great-grandfather, Martin Van Doren Outlaw, was born in Riceville, Georgia, and he was born in the 1870s, and so was my great-grandmother, his wife. And he always talked about baseball, and my great-grandmother, I was fortunate enough to see, she died at 97 in the 80s. And my great-grandfather lived a while. And I'm saying to you this because as a young man, walking up the steps and walking down the steps, we had to walk around my grandfather because he had a ball game on with the radio. And you bring me right back in time to that time period. And his favorite hero in baseball was Satchel Paige. But I remember that he accepted Jackie Robinson because what he liked about Jackie Robinson, but he liked Satchel Paige over Jackie Robinson. But he accepted Jackie Robinson because he told us that the hardest time that Jackie Robinson ever had when he came to Philadelphia was the racism. And his thing was is that he liked one baseball team in the 60s and the early 70s, and that was the Brooklyn Dodgers because of Jackie Robinson. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about my great uncle and my uncles was we've always had these conversations, and this is bringing me to this, that in my time, the greatest boxer of all times was Muhammad Ali. Okay, and I'm 57 years old, right? Born in 51. Okay. We talked to my uncles would tell you that their time, Sugar Ray Robinson pound for pound 100 years. And we talked to my great-grandfather, Mark Van Dool Outlaw, he'll tell you Joe Louis. Okay. So when I took listening to you, and you name these players, that Ali said that he was the heavyweight Sugar Ray Robinson, so he knew where he got his talent, his skills from. So I'm listening to what all you're saying is bringing me right back home to my great-grandfather, and I appreciate that because baseball was his thing. And I think about the movie that I saw. Every time I see that movie, I have it here, Big No Long and Traveling All-Stars, with my greatest actors in there, Billy Dee Williams, James Earl Jones, and Richard Pryor. So I'm happy that you're here, and people give that history that are living. We need you as much as we can. But I also had a conversation with my uncles about, as we were looking at the entry of the African coming into the major league that were white, my uncle said a lot of times we concentrated on that when how football was broken with Willie Strode. He said during that time they put a lot of time in Indian Jackie Robinson. But he said that football being broken had a lot to do with what Jackie did. And then, of course, you had Jack Johnson and all boxes and things of that nature. Right. But, sir, I want to thank you for bringing me to that era. And, I'm thinking of my grandparents, man. Okay. And it's really great.
All right.
I appreciate you coming.
All right. Thank you, Brother Timothy. Brother Griffin, any questions or remarks you have about the Negro Baseball League?
Oh, good evening. First of all, how you doing, Mr. Biddle?
I'm doing fine.
Taking me down memory lane here. Oh, I don't want to tell you what I think I know other than to say I had an uncle that was involved in semi-pro baseball. I'm in New Yorktown, Winsburg, Norfolk area in Virginia. And semi-pro baseball kept going here until about the mid-70s before it really broke up. But in my youth, in the early 60s, it was the focal point of every weekend. And I mean, teams were traveling as far away as 200 or 300 miles to continue semi-pro baseball. And I know it's all a child of what the era you were talking about. So I came in late to your discussion. I might have to go back and listen to the podcast. But does your book cover all the way up to this period in the mid-70s? Because, like I said, I'm in the Norfolk, Newport News, Yorktown area.
Okay. Yeah, the book is called Secrets of the Negro Baseball League as told by Dennis Biddle. It's in all the bookstores. if you want an autographed copy, you can get it from the foundation. But that's the day Negro League Baseball Players Foundation. But the book is in the bookstore. We are attempting to try to get it into all the school system because there's a lot of information in there that will steer our young people in the right direction. And the books that they've been reading has been misleading.
You're kind with that word, with misleading. Okay, intentionally misleading too.
Yeah.
I do applaud your work, and I'll check that out, sir. That's all I have to
okay.
say.
Okay.
Thank yeah. you.
All right, Brother Griffin, thank you so much. I appreciate that. We do have another caller at area code 414-378. I don't know, caller, did you have a question, or you want? Are you just listening?
No, Dr. Rogers, this is Shani B. I was just listening.
Okay,
you know,
wonderful.
I do have a comment. You know, my son actually plays baseball for Riverside, and, you know, just hearing the history and some background about this, I'm definitely going to, you know, go get that book for my son and also, you know, read it with him and, you know, explore the history of African Americans in baseball. So, you know, thank you, brother, for sharing your story and, you know, giving us a lot of insight on, you know, this history that we, you know, so in my generation, we kind of over, you know, look and forget how much African Americans contributed to baseball.
Excellent. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you might want to look at that for your Saturday school, because I know you're getting ready to begin developing a Saturday school for young people. And that might be something you would want to use. So,
that is definitely something, and I'm definitely going to reach out for an autographed copy for myself,
okay,
and maybe for, you know, my students too.
Great, great. All right, thank you. Area code 404-453. I don't know if you had a call or you just listening.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I got a question to Mr. Biddle. Hey, good show, my brother. Hey, Mr. Biddle, you say you played in Memphis, right?
Say pardon?
You say you played in Memphis, right?
I played in Memphis, Tennessee, 1953.
Okay, you probably remember that I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. So my grandfather, Harry Squab Jones, I don't know if you know that name, but he had a team called Athens, Georgia Red Sox, and he also was managing another team called Atlanta Black Crackers. You ever heard of that team, Atlanta Black Crackers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Atlanta Black Crackers was never in the Negro Baseball League. A lot of people don't know that. They think they were, because they were never in part of the Negro Baseball League. They were part of the Southern League,
okay,
not the Negro Baseball League, but the Atlanta Black Crackers. But they were a part of us, because a lot of the players left. And I was told this by some of the older players, that they left to go down there playing in that league down with the Black Crackers. Down there was a league down there called the Southern League. They only lasted mm-hmm. 1 year, they said. But most of the players, they offered them more money than what they were getting to go down. But that's a part of the history that's written down. You can find that in a book called Only the Ball Was White.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember my grandfather named Harry Squab Jones out of Athens, Georgia. I don't know if that name rings a bell. But
I played in 1953 and 54 in the Negro League. Then I went to the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And but like I said, Mr. Sherwood Brewer, who started this organization, and Mr. Bell, James Cool Papa Bell, they called it, they passed a lot
of
history down to me. So I got a lot of knowledge of things that happened back in the day. But you can, up until 1950, you can find our history has been documented pretty good by, you know, Only the Ball Was White. It's a book called Only the Ball Was White. But
okay.
I played during a time when the newspapers and historians, everybody turned and watched us not play in the major league. But see, this is why our history is messed up. See, after 1949, all those black newspapers turned and watched us play in the major league, but the Negro League continued on for another 10 years and a couple of years after. That part of our history was not written down, very little. And this is what you're going to get from me and from the other players that played during that time that are still living.
Right, peace of rest, Doc. I'll let somebody else talk to you, man. But I appreciate it, Mr. Biddle.
Right,
and you gave me a lot of history about the Southern League, man. That's what my grandfather was about. Man. Appreciate it, my brother.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. For any of our listening audience, let me just I'll give you a source that you might be interested in. I think that you could probably get it from your library or either in your be able to get it via the internet. There's a recent journal that has been developed called the Baseball Research Journal. The Baseball Research Journal has some very interesting specific stories about a lot of different things. And one of the things that I used that journal for in terms of this broadcast was to look at it from the business perspective. That was an article written by a man by the name of Japheth Knopp, K-N-O-O-P, K-N-O-P-P, sorry, Japheth Knopp. And he wrote the name of the article is The Negro League Baseball, Black Community, and the Socioeconomic Impact of Integration. Repeat, the topic again is called Negro League Baseball, Black Community, and the Socioeconomic Impact of Integration. And one of the things he did in this was to take Kansas City, for example, and talk about how it had developed around the politic of the day, the economics, the whole struggle over integration versus segregation, and all of that. And so you might want to take a look at that, and probably I'm sure there's some other articles in there that might be of very interest to those of you who are definitely interested in the history of that. And also, like I said, this is also the history of black businesses. There's a book by a guy named Robert Kinzer and Edward Sagrin called The Negro in American Business, The Conflict Between Separatism and Integration. This is really what we're talking about here. There was a push by the NAACP, the Urban League, and other groups to go to integration. The white community was hardcore. They didn't want integration. They wanted separatism. And then when they got into integration, it was used as a tool to manipulate, and it ended up destroying the black community, which is what we saw in those Wall Street, the Black Wall Street of Tulsa, other than through violence. Durham, North Carolina, which was called the Black Wall Street, on Paris Street in Durham, North Carolina, which was a very bustling black community, but as soon as integration came in, it killed it. And so many other institutions like that in the black community were very popular, very powerful, and they were economic strongholds until integration came in. So integration was a serious issue. The Brown decision, we know about the educational system. Everybody tells you, in most cases, that integration killed the quality of children being educated in schools because there was a much better system. I know we didn't have fancy microphones. Microscopes, and we didn't have a lot of the equipment that the white schools had, but we had people that cared for us and people who loved us and people who taught us properly. But when integration came in, we lost all of that. So anyway, this baseball is surrounded by all of those factors. And it's a good chance historically to look at all of that development. And there's a lot of books and things that have been clearly done. Mr. Biddle, I want to ask you about the black church role. I've heard over the years the black church had a very intricate part of promoting the Negro Baseball League activities, as well as being able to make money. A lot of the teams, I understand, used to give the churches an opportunity to lease their concession stands, and they would serve dinners and food on Sundays after the games and so forth like that. Do you recall some of that? And can you talk a little bit about how the churches played a part in that? Uh-huh.
First, I want to say baseball, there were two major leagues, the Negro League and the Major League. Right. One white, one black, and unequal. Now, back to the churches. The churches played a very important part in the making of the Negro Baseball League.
Okay.
Because the minister would let church out early on Sunday so everybody can go to the ball game. And to verify that, all you got to do is look at the stands, see the people sitting in the stand with their church hats on and neckties.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
They're coming from church to the game. And that was a very important part of the Negro Baseball League, baseball itself. I don't know. I never heard of any church owning a Negro League team.
Right.
But they played a very important part in the making of the Negro Baseball League.
What about the Undertakers?
Well, you know, that was a movie out. And I want to say this to my fans. A movie called Bingo Long.
Right, right. Yes.
Now, that's Hollywood made. It was a comedy. And a lot of the black players, a lot of them did now, but saw that movie, didn't think much of it because it downgraded them, a comedy. And they often talked about hell. We called hell. Wasn't nothing funny about that. But one thing that movie did, and I don't think that even the writer knew what they were doing.
Okay.
If you looked at the movie, it had a Undertaker and a woman owning a Negro League team.
Right.
Now, that was a comical part about it. Here's a woman that owned the team, and here's an Undertaker that owned the team. But they did not know the significance that movie had on the true history of the Negro Baseball League.
Okay.
Now, there was a woman on the Negro League team. Her name, Madam C.J. Walker. That's who that woman that portrayed in that movie, that's who they were. The richest black woman in the world. The Undertaker was the man, had a funeral home. He came up with an insurance where each family would donate $1 a week and he would bury everybody in the family. He became the second richest black man in the world.
You remember his name?
The Negro League was number three.
Okay.
Now, that's a part of true history that was passed down to me.
Right.
And I wanted to say that.
So, Madam C.J. Walker owned one of those teams?
That's who they portrayed in that movie. They didn't know they had a woman owning the team.
Okay.
But they had no idea that C.J. Walker, the richest black woman in the world, owned the Negro League team.
I didn't know that either.
And Undertaker was that insurance they had that would bury all the families, black families, became the second richest man in the world.
Was that Gaston, A.G. Gaston?
Yep, that was him.
Right, out of Birmingham, right? What was the name, of that, name of that team in Birmingham? Birmingham had a big baseball team.
Birmingham Blackburn.
That's right, yep. And I knew A.G. Gaston was very powerful, and I knew he owned that. He had owned a team, too. I didn't know. But that Madam C.J. Walker, you just taught me today. I definitely did not know she owned it. Was it the Indianapolis team? Was it the Indianapolis team? Because I know she lived in Indianapolis.
Yeah, Indianapolis, yeah.
Okay, all right. That's amazing. That's powerful. Yeah, that was done by Motown. Motown did that movie, I think, and I remember some of the writers they had been consulted by historians, by black historians, to talk about that story and to look at just how that was done. That's interesting. But I know the churches, I knew that for a fact as well, that the churches were very instrumental working with the there's a sociologist out of a university, I think he was out of University of Chicago. His name was St. Clair Drake. He had a theory. He called it the double duty dollar. The double duty dollar. And what he said is that the black preacher would get up in the pulpits on Sunday morning and promote black businesses. And a lot of the black businesses that he promoted were obviously people that were members of the congregation who had businesses. And so, in a sense, he was working that dollar on both ends. He was helping the business grow among the church members. And by doing that, the business kept the tithes going in terms of looking at making sure that the church was done well because the church had just promoted them. And the church was used in a lot of ways economically like that. I mean, you know the history of the number runners, the number of people used to take would go into church. Right. When the preacher gives the scripture for the Sunday, they would take that number and go back, and they would use that as a number for the number, you know, for hitting the numbers. You know,
and numbers, so yeah.
That was a powerful piece that was done as well. Now, I understand also, I do remember this myself personally. I remember by going to the local Negro baseball games in Durham, North Carolina, that people gambled. They used to gamble while they were at the games. And they would gamble not only on who would win the game, but whether a particular player, when he came to bat, would get a hit or would they strike him out.
And I'm sure some of that went on.
Yep, they would bet on that stuff like that. So there were economic stuff all the way around, you know, in terms of, you know, how this was done as well. I want to ask you about Josh Gibson. Now, I know he played for the Kansas City Monarchs, correct?
Josh played with the Homestead Grays and
Homestead
the Pittsburgh
Grays, Crawford. That's right. Right, okay, okay.
Josh... I met his son and I, he was part of the organization, but Josh died, you know, he died 2 months before Jackie Robinson made his major league debut.
Okay.
He really wanted to be the first one, and it was handed down to me that when Rich Rickey picked Jackie over him and hurt him, he started taking drugs and drinking, and they always, all of them drank. That was no big thing, but right. The drug thing I don't know about. But anyway, he died from a tumor, a brain tumor.
Right.
2 months before Jackie made his major debut. But I was told he was hurt deeply.
Right.
By that, you know, not being the first one.
Because I know you talked about that book, When Only the Ball Was White. I know they did a movie too on that book. I don't know how accurate, because unfortunately I have not read.
It wasn't accurate.
Okay.
It had some stuff. It had some things in there about the Negro League. But if you look at that movie, they had Josh Gibson and Jackie Robinson buddies, friends. Jackie never knew Josh in real life.
Okay.
That's not true.
Okay.
But that's the way the movie went. So.
Okay. All right, yeah, that's Hollywood, obviously, always.
I just want to say this. One of my highlights in my life, not just baseball, but I met Jackie when I was with the Cubs. I met Jackie in 1955, downtown Chicago. We had dinner together. It was supposed to be Newcomb. He didn't show up, but Rock Amanella and Ernie Banks and Gene Baker came, and I was there.
Right.
But anyway, I sat across the table from him. Here I am, 19 years old, looking at this living legend that I read about, heard about. His hair was white. And, being an ex-social worker later on in my life, I had to ask him a question. Did he? I said, Mr. Robinson, did you ever think about quitting? He said, every day. He said, every day, but I had made a promise that I would open the door so other blacks would be able to play in the major league. Jackie told me that. That's something that'll be with me forever.
Okay.
I'll never forget that moment.
You know, that's deep. You know, I want to just kind of pinpoint to our listening audience again, some of the significance in this conversation and this history that we're looking at. We're looking at a time period in American life, in African-American life, when you had some of the greatest men and women on the planet were all contemporaries of each other. The 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, you know, not only are you talking about the sports figures, you know, baseball, the Joe Louis's, the Sugar Ray Robinsons, and so forth. But you're talking about the W.E.B. Du Boises, the Booker T. Washingtons, the Carter G. Woodsons. All of them were existing around this particular time frame. They all were focused in on their area. You had the largest black church in America, Abyssinia Baptist Church in New York City. You had the birth of Malcolm X coming around into this. You had the Nation of Islam, Noble Drew Ali. All of these were contemporaries of this history. And I'm sure that in strange ways that they were interacting with each other in some way or another. And I mean, obviously that's the job of the historian, is to help us understand, you know, just what they did. But as you talk about, as Mr. Biddle talks about this Negro Baseball League, that's some powerful connections to this stuff. The Pullman Porters. We haven't even talked about the whole idea of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and how, and the role that they played in all of this. We did talk about the Black Press. We talked about how they played in it. But also, the Black Press would not be what it was unless it had not been for the Pullman Porters and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, because they're the ones that used to pick up those papers in Chicago and drop them off down in Birmingham and down in Mississippi and Alabama, so that the people could understand that there were better opportunities in the North. All this is connected. This is not disconnected history. So, Mr. Biddle, how do you see that in terms of baseball? In, you know, I mean, it's like a major connector here, major connector.
Yes.
You know, and I think
baseball have brought a lot of black. That's all we could play with baseball back in the day. You know.
Right.
Now it's different, but baseball have done so much for America. That's why they call it America's greatest pastime.
Right.
But you know what? The Negro League made it America's greatest pastime.
Right, exactly. Brother Griffin, you wanted to add something else to this conversation?
Yes, I was listening to him, but I had to be sure it was the very same thing. I read to my son, I have a 25-year-old son, I'm 65.
Right.
Back in about 1995 or 96, I actually read the book to him, and it's called Bingo Long, Traveling All-Stars and the Motor Kings. I had to make sure that's what the movie was based on. It's by an author by the name of William Brashler, B-R-A-S-H-L-E-R.
Correct.
That book actually is a lot more, sounds more truthful than the actual Hollywood movie. And I only wanted to make the point that Dr. Rogers, earlier, we were debating over the power of media, and I heard you say something, Mr. Biddle, that is so important to reiterate here. They took a serious history and made a comedy out of it, and it leaves a bad impression, and it really disrespected the people who actually went through the suffering to make that league what it was, and it kind of depresses the value that it had to the community. That's why I said to you, I know up until the 70s, in my youth, that was an integral part of, I mean, I know families that made money off of, the whole family was recognized for the fried chicken, the potato salad. I mean, and each ballpark you went to was known for a particular food or whatever,
right.
Or even the pies and cakes that they made.
That's right.
So I knew it was an integral part of it. And one of my good friends, his family actually still has wealth that was generated from running the ballpark.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, also the bootleggers made big money off that, because you know Sundays, particularly in the South, they had what's known as the Blue Law. And
well, I ain't gonna tell everything on my kinfolk.
Right, exactly. So at the baseball game, you could get everything. You could get liquor, you could get food, you could meet men and women, met each other. That was a courting place.
Yep.
Yep. All that took place on Sunday.
I met my first wife at the ballpark.
That's right.
Little Rock, Arkansas.
So that was a communal issue, and I think that it's so important because. Yeah, we're missing that today. We don't have that kind of institution that helps bring families and people together like that that you had then.
Yeah, I wanted to say next 2020 will be the 100th anniversary of the Negro Baseball League.
Oh wow!
And my wife is working on a program where she's gonna try to reenact back when the churches were coming out to the ball game. We're going to have a ball game, and everybody's going to have to wear their hats and ties to react how things were back in that day.
Oh, man. That's powerful. When is it going to be? Milwaukee?
It'll be more on that coming.
Okay. All right. That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, Mr. Biddle, why don't you close us out, kind of give us some roundup remarks and things that we should be able to remember about all of this, because we got about 8-9 minutes.
Okay. I represent the players that are still living that played in the Negro League. I have been, over the years, I have fought the major leagues for trying to get benefits for some of these players that would have been Hall of Famers that given an opportunity, but they never had it. They came up with criteria to get a pension. You had to play 4 years in the major league, 4 years in the Negro League to qualify. Most of those players are gone now. The players that are living now that I'm still trying to get benefits for only played 1, 2, 3 years. So keep us in your prayers. The Major League new commissioner have been notified. He have not answered me yet on this, but I'm going to keep fighting until the end. So I just want to thank everybody for listening to me, and there's so much more. And anytime you want to have me,
Mr. Biddle. Mr. Biddle, did you ever get the? I know a Holy Redeemer Institutional Church of God in Christ was going to house some of your artifacts. Did they ever set? I know Bishop Daniels has a museum now. Did they ever house some of your?
It's being built.
Okay.
It's being built. The museum is being built. It's going to be at Holy Redeemer Church of God in Christ. They are the one responsible for helping the Brewers bring the Negro League ball players to Milwaukee.
Beautiful.
Every year.
Beautiful. Yeah, I was there that year that Bishop Daniels brought you and the players in. I don't know if you remember that. We all gave a presentation that day on the at the Catherine Daniels Center.
Catherine Daniels, yeah.
Yeah, and I know Bishop was very interested always in Negro baseball.
Yeah, and so, Bishop has got the Wall of Fame.
Right.
The Wall of Fame was originally at County Stadium, which is now Miller Park in Milwaukee.
Right.
Bishop got it 9 Mother Daniels Way, and he the Brewers have joined him honoring us. Yeah, he have joined the Brewers honoring us every year. This Wall of Fame.
So there you go with another black church. The black church still being critical. In helping to mold the community. What about Brother Claiborne? I know you were going to do some things with him. Did you ever get that up and going over there?
Who was that?
Wisconsin Black Historical Museum. Were you able to do anything?
Oh, yeah. We are talking now. We have yesterday, Negro League have a traveling exhibit. Negro League traveling exhibit that we go to colleges, universities, libraries, historical. It's going now too, and we are in the talking business now by having standing one that put there.
Beautiful.
At the Holocaust. Yeah.
Yeah, Brother Benson is going to be having his 30th anniversary in a couple of weeks. I understand, and so great. But anyway, Mr. Biddle, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this with our audience. This is a new audience from the one that we had the last time you were on. And I'm very happy that you were able to come and share it here in this community. And I definitely will promise you I'll be having you back on again. So
okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll be looking forward to it.
Thank you, sir. And I thank all of our listening audience for being here today. We'll be back next Tuesday, 8 o'clock, right here on Time for an Awakening. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful and productive
day. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is.
Black is me.